Welcome to Radio Curious. I'm Barry Vogel. Recent research of how the human brain works seems to indicate that at midlife, women start to see the world differently. Approximately 37 million American women are now entering their 50s and 60s, having fulfilled the prescribed roles of daughter, wife, mother, and employee, and are now ready to retire. Yet, they want to do something more. Suzanne Braun-Levine, our guest in this edition of Radio Curious, has been reporting on lives of women like herself for many years and is the author of Inventing the Rest of Our Lives, Women in Second Adulthood. I spoke with Suzanne Braun-Levine from her home in New York City and asked her about the recent brain research and anthropological findings relative to women in their 50s and 60s.
What anthropologists are finding is that the human animal is different from all other mammals in one major respect, among others that we all know, which is that the female of the species lives an extended period of time after the period in which she can procreate. And they've tried to figure out what this could mean and why evolution created this extra stage of life. And one of the reasons for that seems to be that in order to care for babies and young humans, it takes more than one female, and that the older females then are able to protect and nurture and gather food for the younger ones. Another sort of psychological evolution that anthropologists have been looking at is the fact that men seem to go from an early adulthood in which they are kind of full of themselves and feeling great mastery over the world into a period of sort of psychological decline where they feel that that mastery is leaving them. Women, on the other hand, seem to go from a period of tremendous dependence and concern about who's in charge into this older period, which Margaret Mead called a period of postmenopausal zest, in which they feel increasingly a sense of mastery and ability to function in the world. This is not only obviously biological, but it is also sociological, and it's very much part of the story that I'm trying to describe for women who are entering what I call second adulthood.
In your book, Inventing the Rest of Our Lives, Women in Second Adulthood, you give examples primarily with North American women. And tell us about those examples. What are you seeing?
Well, I think a lot of the new stage of life that I am trying to define and describe and help women understand about their own lives is related to the fact that women in my generation spent our first adulthood, our kind of growing up maturity, in a time of tremendous opportunity for women and exploration and empowerment and an explosion of role models. So that when we come to this extended stage of life, which we have been granted because of increasing longevity, better health, sense of being able to earn a living in the world, we bring to it a great again, this word, sense of mastery and a curiosity about the world that isn't about to fade because we've turned 50 or 60.
Well, are you saying that this is peculiar to your generation and that people in our mother's and grandmother's generation didn't have this?
Absolutely. And when you said North American before, I think that there are women in other cultures at other historical moments for whom this isn't the case. For us, it's a confluence of being a particular moment in women's history, a particular moment in the history of aging, and just the kind of state of mind that we have developed as we went through what to distinguish from second adulthood, I call first adulthood.
Why here now? Is it that you say it's a confluence of ideas, a confluence of opportunities that's not existing in other areas?
Right. Well, I think it's absolutely clear to most women who are going through this kind of odd, confusing, exciting transitional stage into a new stage of life for women that our mothers neither had the opportunity or really the faculties to meet this challenge the way we want to. Now, there are certain exceptions, and I am lucky enough to have a mother who is one, who really took hold of her life at age 50 and is still going strong at almost 90. But for many women, when we look to previous generations, we see that women kind of bought into the idea that when they used to call menopause the change of life, and the rule of thumb seemed to be that when you entered the change of life, your life stopped changing. And we all have images of grandmothers who kind of retreated and got smaller and quieter and more fearful. And one of the interesting things about being a woman in her 50s and 60s now is how we are perceived by women in their 30s and 40s who are looking to us to define the road ahead of them. And everywhere I go, I'm so struck by how many young women want to hear what I have to say about women's lives.
Tell us, how would you define the road ahead for women in their 30s and 40s?
Well, it's a good question. In a lot of ways, it's very reassuring, because when you're in your 30s and 40s, you're always making trade-offs. I'll devote this much of my energy and time to my family, but maybe I'll cut back from my work. I will not get my nails done in order to work on a project with my three-year-old. You're always trying to keep your priorities straight and make trade-offs. I think it's very reassuring for women who are in that crunch to be able to look ahead and say, the things that I've traded away or traded down now maybe will still be available to me 10 or 15 years from now when I can really throw myself into them. So I think that's a terribly important message. I think the other message is that as they look at us and see what a good time we're having, that they will begin to join us in tearing down the image of older women as somebody who is or should be invisible and brushed aside and who isn't attractive or appealing in any way, that older women have a tremendous opportunity to redefine aging for women.
Suzanne Braun-Levine, author of Inventing the Rest of Our Lives, Women in Second Adulthood, what do you see historically that has brought about this confluence that you spoke of earlier?
Well, the most immediate historical period has to be the women's movement of the 70s and 80s. I was the editor of Ms. Magazine during that time, so I was really right where the action was, which was extremely exciting, a little scary, but very exciting. And it's almost impossible to remember things like, in those days, in the 70s, in order for a woman to get a loan, she had to have her husband co-sign the application. Girls played basketball. I loved basketball, and we played half court, because it was thought that girls didn't have the stamina to play the real game. At Ms., we used to ask people to predict what was the last thing that would change in the culture in terms of opportunities for women. Over and over again, the prediction was that nobody would ever accept a woman newscaster because a woman's voice would never be taken seriously. When you think of this kind of thing changing in our lifetime, you can imagine how much expectation women in this generation have for expanding opportunities.
In your book, you have a series of vignettes of stories of different women. Can you draw on some of those?
Well, what I tried to do with the stories is to show people how women, real women, are leading their lives, how they are confronting adversity, rolling with the punches, figuring out how to make things work. Dealing with the challenges that this whole new life experience brings them. And in each chapter, I tried to tell a couple of stories. I can tell you one or two. I can tell you one that I came upon after I wrote the book, a woman I met who I thought was so interesting in terms of how her experience illustrates how random the opportunities are for us and how important it is to be open to them. She had been in the Army for 20 years and had retired, but she was obviously in her late 40s, and was looking forward to figuring out what retirement would be like, what would be fun, how she would handle it. And within a month after she retired, she was diagnosed with breast cancer. And everything obviously fell apart. She went through a long but successful period of treatment. And while she was recovering at home, she had to be in bed, she started watching the Food Channel just to sort of get her mind off things. And she got really hooked. And after she got her strength back, she said, you know, I'm going to go to cooking school. This looks like fun. So just by putting one foot in front of the other, she got to cooking school. And lo and behold, she really got a kick out of it and seemed to be pretty good at it. But the real breakthrough came with the very last course in the program, which was ice sculpting. And she just flipped for ice sculpting and turned out to be really good at it and is now running her own business, making more money than she ever did in the Army. And she wakes up in the morning and she said, who would ever thought that Sergeant Betty Jones within 3 years would be recovering from a mastectomy and a successful ice sculptor. So I use stories like that to try to illustrate how unpredictable but full of promise this stage of life is.
How does this ability, the opportunity to take advantage of the random opportunities, become available to women of substantially lesser economic means?
Well, that's a very important question, and a point that I try to make in the book is that it's absolutely clear that unless you have a baseline of financial stability, you cannot go after these opportunities. And actually, I think one of the ways in which women who are going after these opportunities can play an important role in the future of society is to work in areas, to volunteer, to take jobs, to be politically active in areas that will promote better health care and more economic equity. The other part about economic considerations is that many women in my generation were very unwilling or unable to really learn how to manage money. And many of them have what they call the bag lady syndrome, which is this terrible feeling that from one day to the next, they could find themselves out on the street surrounded by shopping bags with their belongings in them, and that they really need a man to help them manage money. And this is changing, obviously, and there are now many, a good proportion of the women who are I'm talking about are much more savvy about money than they probably were 20 years ago. And the younger women are much more savvy about money. But the bottom line is that economics play a tremendous role in this stage of life.
And how about the same issue to women of color?
Well, I thought when I went out to interview women that I would find big differences between the experience of women of color and Caucasian women, and even Asian women. And I was quite surprised to find that there is more commonality in terms of the sense of relief and of optimism as they get older, the explosion of sense of fearlessness. I think women of color have always been much more outspoken, much more willing to sort of get in your face. And the rest of us are catching up with them now. I think one of the great joys of this stage of life women are finding is the courage to stand up to people, to talk back, to speak your mind. The other thing that is that women of color may have had a head start on, but we are now all very aware of, is the importance of friendship, girlfriends. What one woman who actually is a black woman who is a friend of mine called a circle of trust. The idea that we all need to have a core group of friends who will be there for us as we go through this totally unpredictable stage of life. And I do believe that without that, it's very hard for a woman to get through this with a sense of joy.
Well, that seems to me that would affect all people worldwide, regardless of gender, economic means, or skin color.
Oh, I think so. I think friendship is one of the great human conditions. But what I'm saying about this stage of life is because there are so many unknown quantities, because we're trying out new behaviors, because society isn't always receptive to our efforts, it's especially important to have a group of people who you believe in, who believe in you, who will tell you the truth, who will stand by you, who will make you laugh in order to deal with some of these negative things.
So for a woman who is in doubt, uncertain as to how to take the steps to begin the second adulthood, where should she walk?
I guess the first thing is to know that you're not alone, that if you're feeling you're beginning to develop new kinds of dreams, if you're beginning to behave in ways that people say, gee, that's so unlike you, you shouldn't think it's menopausal madness. You should believe that this is a side of you that is coming to the fore, that it'll be fun to get to know, and that it's the unknown is tremendously frightening.
You mean we don't have to be like the way we were 20 years ago?
That's right. That's right. One of the phrases that I use in the book is that you are not who you were, only older. That this is a stage of life at which you can really redefine your priorities. You can literally invent the experiences that you're going to go for in your 50s, 60s, and 70s.
But for money, some people can't do this.
As I said, it is not, but this is not an experience for the well-off. It's very important. What I found was that if you are at a point where you're not scrambling, you know, to put food on the table, if you are leading a life that feels safe, that the opportunities I'm talking about are available in all corners of the economic spectrum. And it is not about becoming a church lady or a volunteer lady or traveling around the world first class. This is about exploration and self-discovery, and it can happen in any context.
You give a lot of weight to the Supreme Court decision of Roe versus Wade. What is some of the empowerment that you give to that Supreme Court decision?
Well, the bottom line always was that if a woman does not have control over what is happening in her own body, she can't have any control over any other part of her life. And to be forced to bear a child, if your judgment is that the circumstances don't support that experience or your ability to be a parent, that with good medical judgment that you can get from doctors and other people, that it's a hard decision but an important one to be available. Even if a woman isn't ever in need of an abortion, the idea that that there is the framework in place to enable her to control her own reproductive life, I think is terribly important.
What do you see the potential fallout if the Supreme Court were to reverse Roe versus Wade?
Well, I think the real danger is that, and we've talked a little bit about women who are in economic constraints. It's the poor women who will suffer. The women, it's already the women in Mississippi who have no abortion clinics, who can't afford to take 2 days off and travel to another state where they might get an abortion. It means more women taking chances with their own bodies, by trying to find other ways to terminate a pregnancy. I think it would be a real setback for women, and I think it would be a physical danger to women.
Suzanne Braun Levine, if a woman were to start some of the ideas that you discuss in Inventing the Rest of Our Lives, what happens if it doesn't happen now?
Well, the big revelation for me in talking to women about this book has been coming to understand how hard it is for women to give themselves a little slack, to be patient with the process of transition from one life experience into another, to be supportive of your own self and say, okay, this is confusing. I don't know what I want to do with the rest of my life. I need to live with these questions for a while, not to feel that you're losing your momentum or losing your mind or losing your powers to deal with the world, but this is a transition that is comparable to adolescence. And if you think that adolescence takes a couple of years to turn a kid into a semi-adult, you can give yourself a little respect to take the time that this transition takes.
Do you see a comparable transition in men?
Well, men have a little different experience. They are coming off of a time in their lives where they were really at their peak. And it seems to me that at this point, anyway, men are going in a different direction, which is not to say that men and women have to be are going to lose contact with each other. But I do think that men are kind of coming down off of a high of power, and women are reaching out for new opportunities. So I think our trajectories are a little different, but I think our compatibility may be even enhanced.
Suzanne Braun Levine, author of Inventing the Rest of Our Lives, Women in Second Adulthood, thank you very much for being with us on Radio Curious. And can you tell us about an interesting book that you've read lately?
Yes, Barry. I'd like to tell you I've read Alan Alda's Never Have Your Dog Stuffed. And it's a wonderful, funny, very enlightening autobiography. And I am a big fan of biographies and autobiographies because I'm always trying to figure out how life works and how it worked for this person or that person. And he answers those questions in a way that I found very funny and very helpful. So I highly recommend it.
Suzanne Braun Levine, thanks very much for being with us on Radio Curious.
Well, thank you, Barry. I enjoyed it very much.
Suzanne Braun Levine is the author of Inventing the Rest of Our Lives, Women in Second Adulthood. The book that she recommends is Never Have Your Dog Stuffed and Other Things I've Learned by Alan Alda. Copies of this and other editions of Radio Curious can be found on our website, www.radiocurious.org. They're also available in CD format for $10 each. At Radio Curious, we appreciate your thoughts and ideas about our programming and enjoy hearing from you. Our address is Post Office Box 7, Ukiah, that's UKIAH, California, 95482. Our email address is curious@radiocurious.org. You've been listening to Radio Curious. I'm Barry Vogel. Thank you for joining us.